Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucking knots? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Welcome new people. Welcome all. Big show today. Lily Tomlin's on the show. Lily Tomlin, who I've wanted to talk to for a long time, and I talked to her. It was a big day that I talked to her. It was a big day of talking to people, and we got off on some nice tangents, and we got into some good information, and we got had a couple laughs. It was a very, it was an honor to talk to a Lily Tomlin. I'll get to that in a minute. Let's talk about my tour. You want to? Thursday, January 30th, Cleveland, Ohio, at the Agora Theater. I'm telling you these dates again, especially on these larger guest shows, because this might be it, folks. You never know with me if I'm going to hang up my laughing shoes. Is that a thing? Do you have laughing shoes? Laughing gloves? Going to hang up my laugh mitts. Might hang up my laughy mittens. Friday, January 31st, Grand Rapids, Michigan at the Fountain Street Church. Saturday, February 1st, Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom. Friday, February 14th, Orlando, Florida at Hard Rock Live. Saturday, February 15th, Tampa, Florida at the Straz. Going to be at the Straz Center. Thursday, February 20th, Portland, Maine at the State Theater. Friday, February 21st, Providence, Rhode Island, Columbus Theater. Saturday, February 22nd, New Haven, Connecticut at College Street Music Hall. And Sunday, February 23rd, Huntington, New York at the Paramount. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for links to all the venues. I'm definitely going to need my laugh mittens for these shows, some of them. Del Rey is going to be opening for me at all of them. Del Rey has covered more territory than I have. I think Del Rey's been to some of these markets already, so you get to see Del Rey twice if you're a Del Rey fan and a Marc Maron fan. Or perhaps you're just coming to see Del Rey. I don't care what you do. I'll have my laugh mittens on. I'll be ready to go. My funny long johns, my hilarious red union suit with the button-down butt thing so you can poop out of it, little trap door on the back. Maybe I got one of those. I used to have one of those. You know, when you look back at the clothing you've had, where are those pants? Am I right? Am I? Where's my union suit? What happened to that red union suit I had? I used to wear it in Boston. I used to wear it in Maine. I used to wear it back in the day. Had beautiful sweaters. Big cardigan sweaters. Are they cardigans? Pullovers. I had, like, what happened to those wool pants? I had some amazing sort of, like, I think they were Danish military issue wool pants that I wore with suspenders. Thick wool. I had big old boots back in the Boston days. Where's my overcoat? Who's wearing my clothes from back then? Who's got my stuff? I had a couple pairs of wool pants. I was a suspender guy for a minute. Not in a real way, but in sort of a clown way. But anyways, enough about that. I'm going to be in Georgia this week. I think this is the last big chunk of stuff I'm doing for the Aretha Franklin film, Respect. So I'll be down there. Maybe I'll do some sets down there, some surprisers. I'll let you know if you care. I will tell you on Instagram, I believe, is how I'll do it. And maybe Twitter, okay? So I got a beautiful painting from a fan, a woman, or a woman who listens to the show, a painter named Paula Nelson of La Fonda's Head. And it's so beautiful. It's such a nice piece of tribute. It made me very excited. So I have a painting of my cat LaFonda that passed away recently, most of you know. And I thank Paula for that a lot. Someone told me she might be the painter of the things that for Trader Joe's. I don't know what that means. But it's a lovely painting and she does nice work. I think I have her Instagram. I think it is at Whoa, WHOA _Nelson. Is that what you call that? A lower dash, lower slash, or lower, not a slash. I don't fucking know. You know, the underline thing. So, yeah, that was very nice. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Paula. I appreciate that. So last night I went to a thing. I was invited to a thing, and Lynn and I went to a thing. She's a film director. It was a film thing. And I think I primarily went to it because I thought she would enjoy it. And I believe we did. And I didn't know about the movie. Here's what I'm getting at. This guy I know, He's a fan of mine. He's also an artist in his own right in a lot of ways. Peter Konheim. He's in the band Negative Land, but he's also a film archivist. And he invites me to a lot of things, and he sends me records and stuff. And I've not really gone. Like sometimes I'm in the Bay Area. He'll be like, "You want to come over to my basement and see a pristine print of Klute?" And I'll be like, "I don't know, Peter. I don't know. I don't think I do." But it's not. It's a time thing. But anyways. He had a big part in the restoration of this film, which I knew nothing about. It was called Spring Night, Summer Night. The director is J.L. Anderson. It's in this program over there at UCLA. It's the Film and Television Archive, okay? They got a program going over there. It's American Neorealism. Now, look, I'm no dummy. I'm half an intellectual. I studied film in college, but it had been a long time since I went to an event or to see a film that was specifically in the context of not just archiving, but, you know, a series of a certain type of film. And also, like, it was a film nerd event in a lot of ways, but it's also a film art thing. It's sort of a found piece of film in a way, a found feature film that has been salvaged from obscurity. And it's been a long time since I've done that. You know, when you're in college, you do that shit. We got to see this movie, then we're going to get a lecture on the movie, and you appreciate it. Now, look, I've got the tools, you know. I mean, the story was kind of stunning and dark. It takes place in rural Ohio, southeastern Ohio. It's almost a Faulknerian tale of a family. But it's like later. I mean, I think it's from 1967, but it was beautiful. And there was a life to it, a vitality to it in this new print that Peter worked on. It's a digital print. And it's the first time I think the film has been shown in its entirety. Maybe, I don't know if it's ever, but it's gone through quite a history. Apparently it was released with some other footage added to make it a little more sordid for the drive-in crowd. And this is the way that the director wanted it. But I don't do that kind of stuff. And the guy who presented it, the people at the UCLA Film Archive, you know, one guy introduced the other guy who had a long beard. This is a 14-year project bringing this thing to the theater. Everyone's very excited. Who's there? It was a pretty packed house. And, you know, it was sort of stunning. And I'd forgotten what it's like to just take that stuff in, but like to go and see an event and hear people speak on the sort of revelation of the movie and the construction of the movie and the archiving and bringing it back to life of the movie was sort of fascinating. One of the guys had a remarkable beard, just a great beard. And this is their life, man. You know, this is their life, is like archiving movies, you know, pulling them out of obscurity or to, you know, decomposing and, you know, so they don't, you know, just disappear forever. And I don't know. I think there was a time where I've talked about this before when it comes to art and context. You know, we're talking about, you know, the program is, you know, American Neorealism. No matter what I know about movies or what I can talk about and how I can talk about it, I'm no fucking deep film nerd. I'm no film academic. I'm no film fucking intellectual. I know what I know, and I know enough to watch it properly. But there's always been this feeling that when anything is sort of revisited by academia or written about in a certain context or put under the umbrella of American neorealism at a certain point in history, I mean, I know Italian neorealism. I've seen Rome, Open City. I know things, but like I automatically think that no matter whatever experience I have watching the film, that it's like I'm missing something. What am I missing? And I think the breakthrough I had maybe last night or recently is that I didn't miss anything. That, you know, you take it in, it's not there to solve all your problems. You know, it could blow you away, it could change the configuration of your synapses, but it could also just be like, I get it. And, you know, it was really amazing for these reasons. And I can appreciate that. And I understand what the context is and why it's there. And it definitely was, you know, something that changed the way I look at something. I guess I've given myself a break, and I think I'm going to see more stuff now. And this sort of ties in with Lily Tomlin, because I watched all of Nashville before I talked to her, and I hadn't seen that film in a while, and I'd forgotten how it ended. And I'd seen it two or three times, and that's a film from 1975, and Lily Tomlin is genius in it. She's like, it's a straight-up acting gig, and it's fucking unbelievable. And the whole movie is sort of unbelievable. The cast is insane. Ned Beatty, Ronnie Blakely, Keith Carradine, Geraldine Chaplin, Henry Gibson, Michael Murphy, Lily Tomlin. Jeff Goldblum has this weird part in it that's pretty great. I believe Lily Tomlin was nominated for an Oscar for her work in the film. And it's definitely a sort of a masterpiece of a sort, as are many of Altman's films. One of my favorite movies is McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And it's a whole different pace, a whole different groove. It has its own context. Altman is his own world. They're definitely, sort of art movies, but sort of lyrical and well-populated and well-financed movies, unlike the kind of independent nature of the film I saw last night, made in 1967 on a fairly shoestring budget in black and white. That's the other thing you learn is that, relatively independent cinema has been around a long time and there's a lot of gems out there. But Nashville, it was great to watch it. It's a weird, dark movie, as are many of the Altman films. And Lily Tomlin was also amazing in Shortcuts. She was coupled with Tom Waits and it was one of the beautiful relationships in that movie. Anyways, from laughing, from her one-person shows, 9 to 5. The movie's like I'm giving her a big buildup as if she's going to walk in here. It was an honor to talk to this woman, and I've been waiting to do it for a long time. So this is me talking to Lily Tomlin, who is on Grace and Frankie, which premieres on Netflix this Wednesday, January 15th. It is the new season. And I talked to her co-star Jane Fonda. Maybe I'll get the other ones. Anyways, me and Lily right now. Listen. Very excited you're here. Are we taking vitamins?
Yeah.
What do you got?
A load of stuff.
Yeah?
They're from my alternative doctor.
The alternative doctor. Do they have a degree?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's an MD. He's a biochemist.
Really?
Then he has an MD.
And it's like nutrition-based kind of deal?
Yeah, with your blood and all that.
Right. Do you find...
I don't feel a bit different.
Nothing, right?
And I must take about 50 a day.
And nothing, you don't feel any different?
No.
Why'd you, Jesus, you're gonna, maybe we should just, you wanna go a lot, about 20 minutes, just take the pills? That's a lot. Do you know what's in them?
Well, I know what the formula is.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't make it myself.
No. What made you go get all the supplements? Because I just stopped taking supplements.
Oh, did you? That's probably smart. But, I'm trying to squeeze one last year out of Grace and Frankie.
Uh-huh. And you were, getting tired? Or
No. I told you I don't feel any differently.
I know, but so, why go? Why go to the guy?
Well, it becomes habitual.
Oh, right.
And he's a good guy.
Yeah.
I like him. He's very smart.
So you've been going there a long time.
But I have a regular doctor, too.
Oh, that's good. You don't just go to the hippie doctor.
Well, he's not a hippie doctor, but he could be construed as that.
I know. I know. I'm being condescending.
I know. I think, it's all right.
I think it's
you're
good.
Misguided.
I know I'm misguided. I stopped taking turmeric because I was told it does nothing. By several nutritionists.
I'm sure you can't even get it to absorb into your body.
That's right. That's what the problem is. But people just do it.
I don't take turmeric.
It's the one thing, apparently.
Although I've got quite a big stash of it when I ordered a big supply.
You did buy it once?
Oh, yes, of course.
And why?
In a liquid form.
Oh, that must be better.
Yeah,
but
probably.
You don't take it anymore?
No, I've got too much to take.
Okay, all right. So I was watching... I never know. I don't know what to, sometimes I don't know where to start. So I actually watched most of Nashville last night.
You did?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in years. And it's so good. It's so good. And then I watched an old Carson from the 70s, I think. An old Johnny Carson appearance.
Of me being on the show?
Yeah. And both of those things made me realize just how time worked differently. That we all had much more time and things just kind of spread out and had a natural pace to them. And it was just human. You were on Carson for, I mean, the segment was like a half hour.
No.
No, but people
sat
there.
What did I do? Did I say anything?
You were talking, yes. It was an appearance where you were talking about your childhood and starting. It was a story about, you're talking about growing up in the basement apartment and the neighbor who lived upstairs who used to come down for dinner.
Oh, yes.
You remember?
Mrs. Spear.
Yeah, Mrs. Spear. Because he was asking you about you know, how you started to be a performer, and he assumed it was when you got a first laugh, but it was actually more connected to your father.
Yeah.
And that, because you told Mrs. Spear what your father was thinking. Do you remember that story?
Oh, yes, I do very well. I remember standing at the foot of the stairs and giving Mrs. Spear a piece of my father's mind.
Right. that was the whole issue, that she was annoying your dad.
And, of course, my mother would just be horrified, and she immediately called Mrs. Spear in to supper the next night and every night after that and treated her like the finest guest in the world. And my father was tickled to death when I did it. You know? So I got that sense of being a little outrageous and audacious as being funny, the winning side of something.
Right. It made an impact with the old man anyway.
Right. With the old man, it sure did.
So this was in Detroit?
Yeah.
But you were born there?
Yes.
Wow. So
But my parents are from Kentucky. They're Southern.
Oh, and they evacuated?
They went north to work.
Yeah? Well, it got bad down there in the South? They just were...
Well, my dad was the kind of guy, he just wasn't going to be a farmer.
Right. So he went to Detroit to the big city.
To play the horses and...
Oh, he's a gambling man.
Yeah. But he worked very religiously. He was a hard worker.
What? Did he do him what?
He was a job setter at a factory.
A job setter?
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
That means somebody who can, he can't really read plans, but he can put a machine together to produce whatever the part is that they need.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of an intuitive gift that he had.
Yeah, he could, could he break down an engine and that kind of business?
I don't know.
Oh. And what'd your mom do?
She was a nurse's aide.
Oh, working with sick people.
With the babies. She worked always with the babies.
Oh, yeah?
She loved that.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
My brother.
Is he still around?
He lives in Nashville. He's a painter.
Really?
He's a painter, and he builds furniture, and he's just artistic.
Abstract? Realistic?
Sort of whimsical.
Oh, yeah? And he sells his paintings?
Yes. He said to me the other day, in 4 years, I'll be 80.
Yeah.
I can't believe it either. I think he's maybe 16.
Oh, really? He's just got the personality of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just can't believe it. My precious brother.
He's going to be 80?
Yeah, and I'm already 80. I said, well, I'm already 80, so.
Do you feel different?
No, I feel nothing different.
Yeah, my mother's the same way. She's like, I don't understand. I don't feel any different inside. I guess it doesn't, yeah. I thought maybe it would have something to do with kids or whatever, but no, I guess you don't really change inside, huh?
I guess not. How many kids did she have?
Just me and my brother.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think she really locked into that for a long time. But I think she notices now.
Oh, my mother was a real homemaker. She loved to. When she was lying in bed, when she had osteoporosis very badly at the end of her life.
Yeah.
She said, I'm lying here just thinking about, because her father had been a prosperous farmer in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And she said, and he had wanted his last two girls to go to college.
Right.
And my mother was one of them.
Yeah.
And she said, I'd give anything to be a home ec teacher.
Oh, really? That's what she wanted? Those were her dying wishes?
Yeah, so dear.
Oh.
Nothing pleased my mother more than a new canister set.
Did she cook and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Cakes?
Yeah, everything.
Oh.
She had a very special gumdrop cake.
Oh, really? With that, was it gumdrops all
around
the top?
Gumdrops inside and on top.
Oh, was it good? Or?
Yeah, it was good.
So were you always in the basement apartment growing up?
No, we moved up to the second floor when I was about 10 or 12.
Same building?
Yes.
Oh, that's nice. You literally moved up in the world.
We did. We did, indeed.
And when you were growing up, were you into watching theater or comics or anything like that?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't have the experience of theater.
Yeah.
My family. I went to the movies a lot.
Yeah.
But I took ballet and tap at the Department of Parks and Recreation across the street.
Yeah.
From our apartment house.
Yeah.
Because that we lived in a sort of wild neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing terribly bad, and certainly nothing compared to today.
Right.
But
just a lot going on in the streets.
Yeah, a lot of going on, and it was rough.
Yeah,
you know, you could, but you don't realize how rough it is until
when you're a kid.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so I took ballet and tap over there because they had a lot of programs to keep kids off the streets.
Right. Yeah.
And I was over there for about 10 years, from 5 to 15.
Doing dancing.
Dancing and doing comedy, and I mean, I would make up characters to do. We'd have a variety show every Friday.
Oh, every Friday?
Yeah, in the summer.
Yeah.
Not in the winter.
Yeah, right, yeah. So you didn't have to trek through the snow. But so you were doing characters at, what, like age 10, 12, 13?
Yeah, easily.
You brought up on Carson in whenever that was, in the 70s, about a woman who lived in the building that was older than you, but like you were friends with her.
There were a couple of those, but because I was the kind of kid who just had an adult way about me,
right?
And so Betty Paterka and Jimmy LaFont,
yeah,
they were like about 25, and I was 10,
yeah.
But and they were like the glamour, exciting girls. Like Betty's boyfriend slept over,
yeah,
and that was really hot stuff. And Betty and Jimmy was married,
yeah.
And she and her husband, every time they would have sex, they put a bean in the jar, and then it took them 3 years to get the beans out.
What?
In 1 year, they put so many beans in the jar, and then after that first year, they took 3 years to get the beans out.
Oh, my God.
But they would tell me stuff like that.
When you were 10.
Yeah, and that was interesting to me.
You need those people to sort of open your brain up.
Yeah.
To the bigger world out
and
there.
And Jimmy was very well-spoken,
yeah.
And Betty was very flamboyant, and... Ba ba ba!
Yeah,
she had a real big figure, and she was hot stuff.
And this
I
was
loved
like
her.
the '50s.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well, the very beginning of the '50s, because I was born in 1939. So
right.
I was 10 by the time I was in 1940. No, so, I mean 1950.
Now, when you think about it, like, you know, seeing how everything's changed over, you know, like the arc of like what happened culturally, it's got to be mind blowing. Because I was trying to think when I talked to people.
I try to figure it out. I can't figure it out.
In terms of what? Which part?
Everything. How does it make sense? How does it not? Look at today with this whole thing.
It's horrendous.
And Iran.
Yeah.
You think, and then you've got someone like Trump in the White House. Yeah. You just can't put it all together.
And even with so much more information, it even makes it more confusing. But I mean, you live through Nixon. You live through, like, you know, I would imagine that. In terms of just fear in the streets, the 60s was horrendous.
Maybe we know so much more now. Maybe that's it. Maybe we're acculturated so that, true. I mean, Nixon, the bombing in Cambodia and everything else that went on. And you think Trump is 10 times worse than Nixon. But in a way, it's sort of like it's only because we kind of know more.
Yeah. How's it happening again?
And
you know, and now we're so much more distracted. But I it's dealing with fear is the hardest thing for me, the fear part.
It's more anxiousness for me.
I guess that's what it is. Yeah, because you do feel ultimately powerless usually things are going on that we don't know about. But you know, when you really start to think about it, you're like, I can't do anything. What can I do? And what can
and
you
especially do? With the climate? There's no recourse.
Nothing. You know, I don't think
Australia is
on fire.
Yeah. And
it's
I have
terrible.
Friends in Australia, and they said it's just grim.
Really?
Yeah.
Like in Sydney, or where are they?
Well, no, they're in Canberra right now.
Uh-huh.
But they used to live in Bermagui, which was just idyllic.
And it's gone.
I went up, it's all evacuated. It very well could burn.
I have no sense of what's happening there, the scale of it, but it seems pretty fucking awful.
Yeah, it's like 10 times worse than what we've seen in California fires.
Yeah.
10 times bigger.
Yeah.
For it to suddenly strike Australia, I saw on the beach, I always thought Australia was far away and the last to go.
Right, yeah. Yeah, nothing's going to happen in Australia.
Yeah.
It's terrible. But I mean, like... I guess your parents probably lived through the Depression and had that mentality. And, like, I guess things change. But the climate does seem like the last frontier.
Yeah, it does. It is.
As far as I
can figure it out.
But going back, before we get fall into a hole of despair.
Yeah, the despair is part of the anxious.
It is.
Except in a certain kind of way, I take it in in the morning. I get up and I'm seeing what's happening. And then we kind of go about our day. I mean, you're doing your show.
What else can you do?
I came here.
Yeah. I said that on stage last night when it was like, this could be the eve of World War III. And, you know, there's all this stuff going on, but we have to get up and live our lives.
Yeah.
Which is just that sort of gnawing anxiousness when everybody has it.
It will allay that fear, that anxiousness for a while. I mean, you get absorbed in what you're doing. Maybe you love what you're doing.
Sure. But when you were in, like, growing up, and when did you start to... Because I do stand-up. Did you do stand-up first?
No, and I'm not really a classic stand-up. No, I've always done characters.
Right.
And I talk in between or something, and there's a certain amount of stand-up, but not like...
Joke. Like, yeah.
Hard-hitting stand-up.
But you were always aware of that? That you categorize yourself as not a traditional stand-up?
Yeah.
Yeah, because why?
Because I did characters.
Right.
And
But you shared the stage with stand-ups. At different times, right? I mean, you go on at clubs, right?
No, I didn't go on at too many clubs.
Never? Oh, yeah.
No, I did, but I didn't really.
Oh, yeah.
Because...
Right. You didn't come up in
the club. I needed time to establish my character. Or I would, if I was going to do a monologue, right. I'd have to have 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 minutes to do the monologue.
Yeah.
Not every audience is going to sit around for that.
That's true.
They want boom, boom, boom.
Well, I don't know. Again, like, you know, watching Carson and also watching Nashville and sort of the pace of things then was a little different. It seems like people were a little more patient. Am I projecting?
Well, they might be patient. I don't know. It depends on who the person is. I mean, if they know you, they might be a little more patient.
Right.
But if you're just starting out and they don't know you, they're not going to be totally patient. Unless you're totally mesmerizing.
Sure. Well, you're pretty mesmerizing.
You're doing something so... Why, I've never seen the likes of this.
Weren't you that?
I was kind of that in a way, but I wasn't the first to do characters.
Sure.
I was greatly influenced by Ruth Draper.
Yeah, I don't know who that
who
is.
Was, who died in 56, and she was in her 70s. And I discovered her when I was about 18 in Detroit on the Written Word, whatever that album is called.
Uh-huh. I think Ruth Draper is her name?
Yeah.
And I don't know her.
That's all right. I can understand that.
It's crazy. I feel like, I feel stupid.
Most people wouldn't know her.
And she had a record, though? She had an album?
She was recorded, yes. Yeah. Because the guy who recorded her, Charles Bowden, he became a good friend of mine because when he first saw my first Broadway show, he wrote me a letter and he said, "You make me think of Ruth Draper." And of course, that was the most heady thing he could have said to me, which was totally... far-fetched, but...
Who was she? How did you come to
know
her?
Well, she was from Boston. She was from a fairly well-to-do family. Her father, her brother was Paul Draper, the dancer, who was blacklisted.
And she was a comedic performer?
Well, not totally comedic, but very funny.
Yeah. She would do characters?
Yeah, characters. And she would do Broadway shows.
Oh, okay.
She would appear on Broadway every few years.
And
she toured the world.
And
she'd get up in a place in Scotland and stand on the table and do her monologues.
Wow. And this was your first big influence, this woman.
Yeah.
And you aspired to it.
I had other influences.
Yeah?
You know, I was very eclectic.
Like who else? Before you started?
Yeah, when I was a kid and we first got it. We didn't get a TV till I was 10.
Uh-huh.
And then my father got an old Muntz TV and they never sent him the payment book. And he just gloated on that for years.
Oh, your free TV?
Yeah. But I saw other neighbors' TVs occasionally, you know, and stuff. But I listened to the radio a lot. I loved Beulah.
Yeah.
The maid.
Yeah.
And she was always muttering some mutiny under her breath, you know.
Yeah,
she'd be saying like, maybe her white employers would call her upstairs, downstairs, and she'd trudging up the stairs and out of breath and tired. And then they say, "Beulah, I need you up here at once."
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be right along. You know, no, Beulah, I need you downstairs at once. I need to see you immediately. I like to take their supper and give it to the dog. What's that you said, Beulah? I said the fire's getting low. I better fetch a log.
Subversive.
I would just crack up at that.
Yeah,
I thought that was totally divine.
Yeah. So that was on the radio. So you liked people that did, you know, funny characters and had a little edge
to them. Yeah, and I had, but I empathized with them. You know, I just, I totally got them.
Yeah. And when did you first start putting your stuff to paper?
Well, I did the first character I did was in a show in college. Mm. I mean, that I did like for a real audience.
Right.
And it was a scholarship show to raise scholarship money. And a long to do about getting there and everything. But
what, to college or to?
That's about true. Getting in this show.
Yeah.
And they I had done a show on the big stage where I played a walk-on in The Mad Woman of Shiloh.
At the school.
Yeah, for the university. Yeah. And I had to lead an improvisation of the capitalist women down the staircase being cast into the mad woman's cellar.
Uh-huh.
And I would just carry on every night, you know.
Yeah.
And all the kids who were drama majors, they would just all run out to the stage to see what I was going to do.
You're just improvising?
Yeah. And I thought, geez, this is so much fun.
Uh-huh.
And Iris Gorin, who lived in Detroit, I've tried to reach her 100 times because she sort of looked like Barbara Streisand at the time, and she would look at me so intently and she'd say, "Do you realize what kind of concentration you have?"
She was a teacher.
She was a student, but she was a drama major.
Okay.
I had no idea.
And she was impressed with you.
Very impressed with my concentration, at least.
Yeah. So that was your, that's how
So I did that, but then I got into this scholarship show where it was funny, where they were doing funny stuff, sketches.
Right,
And so I had I'd bombed out on everything because it was just terrible material.
As a student or what?
As a player in the... they gave me all the female parts, and then surreptitiously they took them away one by one because I couldn't sell it.
Oh,
I mean, who's going to say like play Miss Kitty and say, you know, pour Matt whatever his name is a cup of coffee and real beans fall out.
Right. Okay.
And they say good to the last bean.
You're not going
to
do it.
It just didn't make sense
to
me.
Sell it.
No. I couldn't sell it. And so gradually I had only two parts left.
Were you studying?
I only had one part left.
Were you studying drama?
No, I was studying med. I was in pre-med.
Oh, God.
Oh. That was another fantasy.
Yeah. How'd that go?
Well, I didn't finish, so it didn't go anyway.
Yeah,
There was no decision on the.
You didn't finish college?
No, okay. I didn't finish. I got into this show.
Yeah,
and I had been humiliated, and I had one last thing to do.
Yeah,
and it was a takeoff in the Academy Awards, and I pretended I was ad-libbing.
Right,
like trying to read cue cards.
Right,
and I would just say things like academy.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, here at the academy, and just...
Right, right.
And that was getting big laughs. And so then I was kind of buoyed and renewed.
Yeah.
And so then you have to insert another story here to explain how low I had gone.
Okay.
There was a girl in the show.
Which one? Which show?
In this...
The review?
The review.
Yeah.
And she was like 5'10", and she had blonde hair, and she hung over one eye, and she wore French-cut electric blue tights, you know, with your buttock cheeks are showing through the tights, but the leotard is cut way up. It's like wearing a, you know, what's those underpants called? Thongs.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like that. You have high heels on, a lot of jewelry.
Right.
She was
something.
Yes. And she was leaning against the piano with her long legs stretched out. She became a good friend of mine later. So I'm not using her name.
Right.
And I was mumbling my Academy Award speech over on the side, like real pitiful.
Yeah.
And she swung around like that, and her hair just ripple, ripple, ripple.
Yeah.
And a Clairol ad. And she said, "What did you say?" She hadn't said a word to me in weeks.
Right.
And I said, I was just staggered to my depths. And she said, "Well, if you can't be direct, why be?" And that was the last thing that I needed. And I went out. That's when I went out there and ad-libbed that piece.
So these are just—I like these passing bits of.
But wait a minute! The character I did the old tasteful lady that I did on Laugh-In eventually.
Yeah.
And I'd never really done her as a character. It's just that. My mother's maiden name was Ford.
Yeah.
And so she used to read all about the Fords in the society page.
Yeah.
And Charlotte Ford was my age, and she was making her debut party at that time. and it was reputed to cost $500,000 or something. And I had borrowed a car and taken my mother on a tour around the Grosse Pointe estate so she could see the twinkle lights and the canopies.
Yeah.
And the car was tied on the driver's side with a rope. The door was tied shut.
This is your family car?
No, I borrowed it from a friend. and so all this stuff intertwines because my life has been preordained.
Right. Okay.
And so years later, when Kathy King, who was a cheerleader, I'd gotten her on the cheer team at Cass Tech, which was my high school. And so she had, and she was married to Henry Ford. She was his third wife.
Really?
Yeah. And so she had all the old cheerleaders over at their big house, you know. Mm-hmm. And she called my mom on the phone and she said, "Mrs. Tomlin, you can come in the front door now." So that was divine. It was a lovely moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's still not the story.
Yeah.
The story is I did a Grosse Pointe matron.
Yeah, okay.
And
as the character.
As the character. Yeah. And I talked about my charitable activities and my social work, my social activities and all that stuff. And then I get up and I bid the audience a very tasteful. And we knew that Grosse Pointe had been designated unlawfully a segregated community.
Yeah.
So that's what it played on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I could just ad lib around that, you know,
right,
and do the character. And I had a young guy that I was friendly with. He interviewed me, like he had a show called Distinguished Guest.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got up, I have my dress, I didn't flash or anything. My dress was of a decorous length. But I, you know, like a woman, 50 years middle age, she might get up and push herself up off her thighs, you know, put her palms down near her knees and push herself up in a very, this was high hilarity in 1962.
Yeah. But you killed. You did great.
I killed him.
Yeah.
Because it was the only thing that was relevant that was in the show.
Right. And it was actually.
So I went on all the TV shows and did it.
Oh, that character.
Yeah.
She became the tasteful lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did this take place before you did the, where was this show, the one you just told me
62.
About?
62. It was at Wayne State University.
Oh, okay. Okay. And then after that, you quit school.
Yeah. I went, as soon as we finished midterms, I went to New York.
Yeah.
I thought, well, geez, I'm going to become an actress or something.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny to me that these two passing people that you knew, the one that looked like Barbara Streisand, who said, what did she say you're about your
Do
focus?
Do you know what kind of concentration you have?
There's that one, and then the one who said, if you can't be direct.
Like YB.
Yeah. Those were pretty important.
They were very important.
It's weird how it just went.
And then
people,
she went to New York, and we were friends for many years.
She was an actress?
Yeah. That was her desire.
Uh-huh. And it didn't come to pass?
Not so much.
Mm. So when you got to New York, what'd you do?
Well, I liked a kind of a bohemian life.
Yeah.
I didn't mind it at all. Those girls were kind of disappointed if they were like living on the Lower East Side or something. You know,
is that
I liked
where you started?
The color of it.
Did you start in the Lower East Side?
Yeah, well, I started on I started on 2nd Avenue over the B&H Dairy.
Yeah.
Do you know that?
The 2nd Avenue and
7th Street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I went in there.
B&H Dairy Restaurant.
What?
The restaurant?
Yeah, B&H Dairy.
I think
it's still
there. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And so I had a girlfriend. She wasn't really a girlfriend. She was kind of an acquaintance, but I knew she lived in New York now.
Right.
So I had called her when I went, and I had total Holly-Golightly damage.
Yeah.
I used to wear my hair I didn't have big, abundant hair.
Right.
But what I had, I would pull up, and I'd put it in and then I would spread it out.
Yeah.
Like a ponytail on top of my head.
Yeah.
Then I'd spread the ponytail out and pin it down with hairpins.
Right.
So I had a nice Nefertiti profile.
It sounds like it took some time to put that together.
Well, I've seen photographs, and you wouldn't have guessed I spent a lot of time. Anyway, so I got a white, a cream-colored trench coat at the thrift shop.
Yeah.
And a couple of items like that and I got a $19 one-way trip on Continental Airlines.
So you flew.
Yeah.
$19. Detroit
to
New York?
Detroit to New York.
Yeah.
$19, right.
On a prop plane.
Non-scheduled Continental prop.
Yeah. That's exciting.
And later I became friends with Audrey Meadows, who was married to Bob Six, who was president of Continental.
Audrey Meadows from the Honeymooners.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was funny.
Oh, she was. She was on one of my specials.
Yeah. But like, what? How did you get started doing what you wanted to do in New York?
Well, I had $15 left in my pie. I borrowed $5 from 9 friends, $45. I bought the trench coat.
Yeah, right.
And extra hairpins for me.
Get the hair up there.
And so I had $15 left, and I was going to get a job as a waitress at the Figaro.
Okay.
Which was like about as cool as you could possibly be.
Coffee shop, right?
Yeah, over in the village, in the West
Village.
Still there. Yes. So I went, and of course the guy had a list of girls this long that wanted to be waitresses at the Figaro. And all I had was a burlap skirt. I had one little checkered suit.
Yeah.
With a bolero jacket, kind of, you know, and I had one pair of high heels.
Yeah.
Because when the Figaro thing fell through, and I knew that night, and I spent the $15 on dinner, I went back home. I bought a New York Times on Saturday night late.
Yeah.
And I looked in the newspaper and wrote down all the typist jobs, assistant bookkeeping jobs. Yeah. Let me think. Typist jobs were terrible, like $45 a week.
Yeah.
But assistant bookkeepers were like $85.
Could you type?
Oh, yeah, I could type. I took typing. Like any good girl, I took typing at my age.
Yeah.
But I had also worked as an assistant bookkeeper in Detroit.
Right. So you got...
I could post a ledger.
Right. So that's a needed skill.
Yes.
And that's the gig you got?
So I stopped at all the places, and they were horrible, like button factories and all that stuff.
Finally,
I get to up in the 50s, mid on Fifth Avenue, and I go to BMI Management.
Publishing? Oh, the management company?
Yes, I had no idea when I took the phone number out of the paper, and it says Captain Kangaroo, Dick Clark Productions, and all like that.
Yeah.
So I got that job just like that.
So you're in.
I'm in, and I'm in show business.
You're in show business.
I didn't even know, but I was really kind of the office flunky.
Yeah.
There were 3 other women in the office. Gloria was the bookkeeper, and I had to assist her. And if you're assisting someone, you don't have to know too much.
And what year is this?
62.
Wow.
It's getting to be like almost summer of 62.
Yeah. How long did it take you to realize that you're in this like center of show business?
I saw it as soon as I saw the door. I knew it. I knew.
Did you see Captain Kangaroo around?
Didn't say Captain Kangaroo. It said Charles Keeshan. I didn't realize that was Captain Kangaroo, but I could understand Dick Clark.
Yeah. That's big.
But they also handled all the newscasters.
Yeah.
I mean, 90% of the top newscasters.
And
I used to write all the alimony checks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so had to get them out on Friday night.
Wow.
Anyway, sometimes I failed to do it. I'd be so glad to get rid of the place because Rita and Florence, who were their secretaries, they were so great.
Yeah.
And I've seen Florence since, and she's come to my show a couple of times.
Wow.
But like I would pour a, they had a cooler.
Yeah.
And someone would dump soup in the receptacle there.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it. I wouldn't dare do it.
So there's no drain.
And here Rita, she'd say, come here. I couldn't understand them. They were from the Bronx.
Yeah.
I said, what? She said, look at this. Who did this? You must have done this. No, I didn't do that, Rita. Clean it up. Then I'd have to go and get things for them, for their different things like creams, change a brassiere, do this on my lunch hour. And there was nothing worse than walking around in New York City in the summer of 62.
Yeah, too hot.
Forget that.
Yeah.
But the construction workers, it's like they're wagging their tongues at you. Yeah. Oh, and just on and on. It was just unbearable.
When did somebody notice you performing? When did you start to get to do the performing?
Well.
In New York.
My friend Louis.
Yeah.
Louis St. Louis, who had several credits. He was a musical director and he wrote songs and he performed himself. But he and his partner were going to perform at the Bitter End.
Right.
And he got me on the bill.
Yeah.
As a, you know, to do. So I kind of threw stuff together that I had.
This was the first show at the Bitter End?
Yeah.
Bits and pieces? Characters?
Yeah, bits and pieces.
How many of those characters stayed with you for a lifetime?
Well, one of them for sure. The world's oldest living beauty expert. She's really, kills me.
Where'd you do her? Did you do her on?
I've just done her in my act. I've never done her on television.
Well, oh, really?
I have done her on television.
Yeah.
As a guest on something,
sure,
I might
sure.
have done it.
Right.
Oh, I went to mime school first.
You did?
Yeah, because being an actress was like, you know, in downtown it was considered too narcissistic.
Uh-huh.
And men were the only creators anyway. You know, the women rolled the joints, had babies.
Yeah.
I didn't
it wasn't your
see
bag.
That cut out for
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
But I was sort of afraid to stand up and say I'm an actor.
Yeah.
So I was going to study mime.
Uh-huh.
That's more acceptable.
Where'd you study mime?
With William Curtis, the American Mime Theater.
Uh-huh.
I lasted 3 weeks. It was just too arduous for so little reward. You just couldn't get anything out of them, you know, because and the other kids were so gifted.
Yeah, with mime.
Yeah, they could tumble across the room and do the most incredible falls and spills and come up and
do it. Yeah. Not your bag.
No. Although I'm good physically. I mean, I used to be good.
Did it help
you,
you think?
What?
The 3 weeks of mime school, did it help you at all?
Well, I was kind of a natural mime anyway, you know.
Sure. Yeah, you know how to do
that. I had gotten in a mime show. Mm. No, see, I don't remember what year that was. Maybe that was 65.
Yeah. You were in a mime show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the Astor Place Playhouse.
When did the break happen?
Well, the real break didn't happen until I went on the Merv Griffin show.
From New York.
Yes, yeah. I was at the upstairs to the downstairs in 66.
Where's that at?
That was on 55th and, and on the side street off of 5th Avenue.
It was a club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a review upstairs in the big room. They had a little cabaret review. And then Mabel Mercer was in the downstairs room.
Yeah.
And I was just mad for Mabel Mercer. Lewis and I had... We used to walk up to the Bonsoir. We'd have just a quarter for the coat check because you could stand six deep at the bar and never even have to buy a drink.
Yeah.
Because we adored Mabel.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mabel was falling out of favor, not doing as big a business. Joan had become very popular.
Joan
from Carson.
Yeah.
And she took over that room in the downstairs.
Yeah.
And Mabel was just there on Mondays, Tuesdays, or Wednesdays or something.
Uh-huh.
And I said to Irv Haber, I was in the review upstairs and I'd gotten a review from Vince Canby in the New York Times. He was
That's
nightclub critic then.
Before film?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I did the makeup lady. That was my main monologue in that show.
Uh-huh.
The character I did, and it stood out because it was different from than the review
the,
kind
the
of.
The beauty tip person?
Yeah. So... he said, it's as if Beatrice Lilly and Dracula's daughter have come into some kind of lunar conjunction.
And that put you on the map.
That was eye-catching.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So it didn't put me on the map so much. I guess it did in one way or another.
But you saw Joan there downstairs early on doing her thing?
Oh, yeah. She was already famous, though, for me.
Yeah. And were you guys friends?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I used to stand in the stairwell and listen to her. She was so funny, outrageous.
Yeah, yeah. Even then, from the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So when did you do Merv Griffin?
So, I took that review around. I took it to an agent called Gloria Sapphire, who was sort of friendly with some people I kind of peripherally knew.
Yeah.
And she sent me over to Griffin.
Yeah.
She said, she sent me to the Paul Simon, I can't think of his name now. I know he's around, or he would be around.
Yeah.
Paul is his first name. But he was the first one that really locked into me and put me on the show.
On Merv.
Yeah,
Merv was in New York at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of the daytime people were. Was Mike Douglas there too?
Mike Douglas, I did him later when
I was well
known.
He was in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, Philadelphia, right.
Uh-huh. So you do Merv.
I do Merv. I started doing Merv kind of, sort of maybe once every month or every 2 months.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's
I would buy the kinescope.
Yeah.
But first I did the world's oldest living beauty expert on Merv's show. And Hermione Gingold was the other guest on the show. And so I was a little nervous about doing Lupe, Madame Lupe.
Yeah. Did it go over well?
Oh, yeah. It went over very well. Because what happens, she rejuvenates her face, and then she sneezes, and it all falls down again. Then I went back to the... I said upstairs. I would go back to the upstairs if I could do one of my own monologues in the show.
Yeah.
That's kind of vaguely.
In the review, yeah.
Yeah. So I went back in 68.
Yeah.
I did a commercial, too. So I made money on a Vicks VapoRub commercial.
Nice. With the little waves coming up? Is that the ones where you rub it and then like it?
Well, I don't think they'd quite hit on those graphics yet.
Yeah, okay.
Those animated graphics. Yeah. It was more like I would be like a housewife, you know, doing the dishes, and I'd hear my husband sneeze in the living room.
Yeah.
And I'd run and get the Vicks VapoRub and rip his shirt off and put it on his chest.
Yeah. Thank God.
So I got to California because a woman, her husband was in the review.
Yeah.
And she was going to populate a show on ABC called Music Scene. And she picked me to go along with David Steinberg was her client.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to go to California. I wanted to be a New York actor.
Right.
I didn't want to be on television.
Mm.
I just wanted to. I didn't want a manager.
You just want to do what? Cabaret shows?
No, I thought I would get. I did audition for some Broadway shows.
Yeah.
And I must have been unbelievably off the wall. I don't know what I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the kid, I'd make friends with the agent's assistant, and he'd say, "What did you do at that interview, at that audition?" I'd say, "What do you mean, what did I do?"
Right.
And he'd just, and I'd be real defensive about it. And then I'd say, and I would like get off a couple of, you know,
so you saw
curse words.
Yeah. So you saw you wanted to be a stage actress.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought I should be. I could go to the clubs and always do little monologues stuff.
But you wanted to do bigger
for
things.
The fun of it. I wanted to be a serious actor.
Right. But you get dragged out to LA.
So I go to California and
to be on
Music Scene.
Music Scene, man. Yeah, 68.
And I picked you, and at the same time, an offer came in to go on Laugh-In.
From George. Yeah.
How'd he see you? He said that he saw me in 66 when I was on the Gary Moore show. That's where Carol Burnett was discovered.
Oh, wow.
So I'm sure he looked at me a few years later and thought, ah, here's my Carol.
Oh, yeah. You know. He probably did see you on that.
Well, I didn't go on Laugh-In until mid-season because I thought, well, Laugh-In's... Everyone's a star who's going to be on Laugh-In.
Yeah.
And Music Scene was like a hip new show. It was like had a tie-in with Billboard.
Yeah. Well, what was it? What'd you do on that?
We were like a little comedy. David Steinberg was the lead, and there were two or three other, and we were like a little comedy troupe.
Interstitial bits?
Yeah, and intro songs that stuff.
So, but Laugh-In is, you go mid-season and Laugh-In 1969?
Yes. I appeared on Laugh-In for the first time December 29th, 1969.
Did you like Schlatter?
Oh, I love him.
Yeah. Do you guys still talk?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It was just his birthday.
Was it? How old is he?
90.
Wow. How's he holding up?
He's doing good.
I talked to him a couple years ago.
Do you?
Yeah, I interviewed him, but I think the entire interview was him trying to get me to do a new Laugh-In with him.
Probably. Yeah.
He was like, this is it. This is the time. The world needs it right now.
Did do a 50th anniversary.
I know. I saw it. It was great.
On Netflix.
It was great. Yeah. It was fun, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was great fun.
So when you did Laugh-In, you moved out here and that was the job,
I was already living here, so I stayed here.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was the job. That's right. I had a 69 Firebird back in New York and I had it brought out to California.
Oh, don't you wish you still had it?
Yeah. It had a Hemi engine, you know, it was very tough.
Yeah.
And they said my makeup artist used to say, we used to say, here comes Tomlin in that bomber or whatever.
Yeah. And I it seems to me that Laugh-In must have been just a blast.
It was.
Like it just looked.
Well, it was just phenomenal because for me it was because literally that first night I aired as Ernestine, it was just a huge, people were stopping me on the streets the next morning.
Yeah.
They'd stop their cars when I was back in LA. They would stop their cars at a light and jump out.
Do the bit?
Yeah. And just, you know, really excited about that, seeing that character, seeing me.
Yeah. Well, you had there were so many characters on there that, like, it must have happened with all the characters.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
At some point. Like, it must have happened with, you know, what's her name?
The little Ruth.
Girl. Yeah, yeah. And it happened with, who else?
Artie, the old, when you do the German soldier.
Interesting.
And then he did the old guy, you know, what I'm here after. You believe in the hereafter, then you know what I'm here after.
Yeah. And then you did, and then the Edith Ann character.
Oh,
was
Edith
huge.
I introduced her the next year.
Yeah.
I went on the road with Dan and Dick when we wrapped at the end of the half season, from the mid season to the summer.
Yeah.
And they would introduce me and they would say, this girl walked out and sat down at the switchboard.
Yeah.
And the crowd would just—it was just like I was
go crazy.
Yeah.
You were a rock star.
I was a rock star for about a minute.
Well, no, then you did the record in what, 71 or 72?
Yeah, with 71. Oscar,
and that, like, that won a Grammy Award, and that was must have made a lot of money, that record.
I guess. I didn't see it.
No? Who did the label?
No, I don't know. I don't remember getting a lot of money from it.
Yeah, but certainly I think it seems like you redefined what comedy was at that time, that the characters became, because there were plenty of stand-ups around, you know, but no one was doing exactly that, what you were doing with all the different characters.
And the characters, they would be contentful. They would.
Yeah,
they would
people loved them. So when did you start working with Altman?
My partner, Jane.
When did you meet Jane?
In 71.
Oh, so that's a big year. Did the record, you met Jane?
I met Jane. Yeah, I met Jane after I was exploiting the record.
Yeah.
I was touring.
How'd you meet her?
A mutual friend.
Oh, yeah.
I came to New York to see for a record party and all that stuff.
And
my girlfriend brought her up to my hotel.
Yeah.
And
that was that?
She wasn't that excited. She didn't seem to know who I was.
And that just drove you crazy.
No. I said, so I put a show on at the Bitter End. I had a dark night, and I had a couple of days left in town. And I called him up, and I said, can I do this? Do a show?
Yeah.
I was doing anything to impress her. So I did a show. I put a show on, and sure enough, she came.
Yeah. Did you impress her?
I didn't seem like I did. I could. I was sure that I would just be like a whiz.
Yeah, yeah. So you had to really fight for it, huh?
I did.
But eventually she gave in?
Yes, she became... she came out and helped me work on my Edith Ann album.
Oh, okay. So she started, like, producing with you pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because she'd written JT, which was in 69. She won a Peabody. I didn't know that this was her history at the time.
Yeah.
But she was a wonderful writer.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't really know any of that.
And JT was a book?
JT became a book, but it was a teleplay first.
Okay.
She wanted to be a songwriter, and she used to go to the Brill Building.
Oh, yeah.
But she'd write these long story songs, which were totally out of fashion.
Right.
And later they became the thing, you know,
American
Pie and all that stuff. But they'd like big guys be like playing those pianos and singing those songs.
Right. And she'd just be hanging out trying to get there. I think there was a bar at the bottom of the Brill Building.
I don't really, I never went to the Brill Building. I don't know.
That was a whole scene,
But it was such a tough thing for her to break into.
Yeah.
And so she'd written a long story about a kid in who was like a bag boy or something. And Gloria Sapphire, just by coincidence, I didn't know Jane knew Gloria Sapphire. She was her agent.
Uh-huh.
So she said, why don't you turn it into a... Jane had never written anything in terms of script or anything. She said, why don't you turn it into a script?
Yeah.
And so she did. And she just has that facility.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a huge hit. She got a Peabody. She won a Peabody. And they played it every year for 25 years at Holiday.
Oh, no kidding.
And so many incredible, like Hilton Als and John Singleton, the director who's recently died.
Yeah.
They were so influenced by JT as kids.
Oh, wow.
Because it's about a black kid in Harlem who befriends a stray cat. And it's so magical and...
Oh, wow.
But
you had no idea that she had written that when you met her.
No.
Oh. So neither one of you knew how impressive the
other
was.
Yeah, the other one was, right? That's right.
And then you had this... you created this amazing partnership that's lasted, what, 50 years?
Yeah.
That's amazing. It's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Not many people pull that off.
I know.
Now, it seems like a short time. It seems like I think you've addressed this a bit, but there was a long period of time where you know you just assumed that people knew you guys were together, that there was no real reason to publicize it. It was a different time, and did you get criticism for that at a certain point?
Somewhat. I mean, sure, people wanted me to make an announcement.
When was this? When did that start? In the 80s?
Oh yeah, easily.
Yeah, and you just didn't feel like you needed to. What was the point?
I didn't want to. I mean, of course, I had some fear about it. My mother had really. My brother's gay, and when he was revealed as gay, my mother just about had a heart attack.
Yeah,
and you know, she's Christian, and But she's really she was a delightful, wonderful person, great conversationalist, witty.
Was she afraid for him?
Just thought he was going to go to hell.
Right.
And
it's so complicated.
It's unfortunate.
With the hell thing. Because, you hear these stories about disowning, but that doesn't seem to be what happened. She was just terrified for his eternal safety.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's pretty heavy.
Yeah, man. And so how did that manifest itself with their relationship?
Well, she very much loved him and stayed close to him, and me too.
Yeah.
And
she knew you were gay as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. But later.
Yeah, later.
Oh, yeah. Did she ever accept it?
Yeah, far as I could tell.
Right. But you knew that it caused her such grief that it didn't seem like there was a point being public about it.
Well, I didn't feel like, I felt like it would just be a lot for her to bear, especially with all her relatives.
Right.
And,
So you just didn't.
So I didn't announce it, no. And then I did in 75.
Yeah.
Time Magazine offered me the cover if I would come out.
Yeah.
And it was just too ambiguous. Come out, get the cover. It was like some kind of bribe. I didn't like it.
So you didn't do it?
And it wasn't, no, I didn't do it.
But you were on the cover, weren't you?
I was in 77. I got on the cover for my first Broadway show.
Yeah, but you didn't have to do the come out deal. That was off the table.
No, it wasn't off the table. Jane was with me all the time. They never wrote about it.
Huh.
And Newsweek was going to do a cover at the same time. That was when Pat Kingsley, the publicist, she was so artful. She pulled off a couple of other duo covers.
Uh-huh.
They don't find out till they've already started the presses running.
Right.
Anyway,
you were both on there? You were both on
No,
the
I was only on Time. Newsweek got onto it.
And that was for Intelligent Signs, for the Time magazine?
No, that was for Appearing Nightly.
Oh, the first
77,
one.
Yeah.
You were the first woman to have a solo Broadway show, yeah?
No, as far as solo, by myself.
Right.
I mean, other people have had shows.
Sure.
Ruth Draper was alone on Broadway.
Oh, I guess that's true. Ruth Draper's back, yeah.
Not quite, but...
Yeah. So all this stuff is happening, and you and Jane are working well together. But in terms of, do you have any regrets about not coming out or no?
In some ways, I do. I mean, I felt like I could have been, it could have been very meaningful.
For people.
It would. I mean, even Ellen paid a terrible price, but she surpassed it.
Sure.
But initially, I mean, she suffered quite a bit.
Yeah, so that was also played into the fear of how would it affect the career and your appeal?
Yeah, always everybody.
Yeah,
everybody's kind of at you about it. That wouldn't. I mean, I'm enough of a showman that I know that it would have been something audacious to do.
Right.
I kind of didn't want to do it for that reason. I wanted it to be. So what I did at that time when they offered me the cover in 75, and you can get this old album and you can hear it, but I was doing a Modern Scream was the name of that album I was doing, and I was being interviewed by a fan magazine. I was playing all the characters.
Yeah.
And I put on the heterosexual interview.
Yeah.
You know, where she says, what was it like to see yourself making love to a man on the big screen? And I say, well, I've seen these women all my life. I know how they walk. I know how they talk.
Right.
And it just went on like that, you know. And I thought, this will be my way of coming out.
Right.
On my own terms.
Yeah. And it didn't quite.
Didn't mean a hill of beans.
No, too subtle.
Was it?
I guess.
Well, anybody, but it wouldn't be subtle to anybody
who was paying attention
or who was
you.
A fan.
Right. Yeah. I guess it was your assumption that most people knew that needed to know, and that was that.
Yeah, many people did know.
Sure.
And there was never any secret. We were never secretive.
Right. It wasn't like you were closeted. You were just not announcing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you meet, when did you start working with Altman?
I had optioned a book.
Yeah.
Cynthia Buchanan, who became a friend of mine, she had written a book called Maiden, M-A-I-D-E-N.
Yeah.
It's hard to make that word clear, Maiden.
Maiden, yeah.
And I just fell in love with it, and I optioned the book.
Yeah.
And Jane wrote a screenplay.
Yeah.
And And then Bob Altman and I had the same agent, mm-hmm. Sam Cohn.
Yeah. Oh, he's a
big
agent.
Now. Yeah, yeah, he was a big agent. He was wonderful.
Yeah.
He was Meryl's agent. He really loved artists, you know.
Yeah.
And he was very devoted to Altman.
Yeah.
And so Altman offered me this part in Nashville, and he was gonna have Joan Tewksbury direct Maiden.
Uh-huh.
And then when we were down in Nashville, the guys from Columbia came down because they wanted him to cut some time out of California Split.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yeah. And he punched one of them in the nose, and he fell in the pool. And
wow! Yeah.
So Maiden got canned
because of that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So Nashville's like 75, and you got nominated for an Oscar, and it was a very serious role. And I watched it last night, and it's a really touching, heavy role. Now, but that seems like to be, as an actress, that you really, you know, did it. And did you want to do more of that type of acting?
Yeah, I wanted to do everything.
Yeah, and you ultimately did. Right, but was there a point where you decided to stick more with comedies or no?
No, but more comedy came my way.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they cast me in more comedies.
Right, and the next one, The Late Show, that was with Art Carney, right?
Yeah.
How was it? What an amazing guy to work with, huh?
Yeah, he was such a sweet guy.
And you must have remembered watching him on television.
Oh, sure, as Norton, absolutely. Yeah, he was something.
And that was another beautiful
But he
role.
So much wanted to be liked by the crew, you know?
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah.
He'd play
yeah.
the piano and he
Oh, really?
And I was like on the outs with the crew. I was like being real abstinent.
You were? Why?
Yeah, because they were moving like lightning. Bob Benton directed that movie.
Yeah.
And Altman produced it.
Uh-huh.
But they were just bouncing lights off the ceiling. We were in a real tiny little house here in L.A. someplace.
Right.
And Art has white hair and a florid skin, and I have sallow skin and black hair.
Yeah.
And I said, well, listen, you guys are going to light me better. This is just not going to work, bouncing light off the ceiling. And they'd say, oh, I'd marry you.
Oh, boy.
That kind of stuff. It was putrid.
Yeah.
And so I finally took a mirror on the set every day and would challenge them to light me.
Oh, wow.
So they didn't like me too much.
Did they do it eventually?
Yeah, and then Altman says, the guys tell me you're giving them a hard time. I said, Altman, I'm not going to take responsibility for this. Because we'd have dailies every day at his office.
Yeah. And when you did 9 to 5, that was a huge event for women everywhere. That must have been like sort of.
Oh, yeah. 9 to 5 was fabulous.
And
I became, and Dolly and Jane, we made good friends. And we've been friends ever since.
But that must have been one of those things where, you know, people now looked at you different. Like you had this whole history of doing characters and everything else. But I imagine after that movie in particular that people saw you in a different light. Like just as like part of that crew, like as sort of a hero to working women in a certain way.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. I never thought of it in those exact terms.
Weren't they? Did they do a Broadway show of it?
Yeah, we were there at the premiere in New York and here, and it was so surreal because from the audience it looked like us.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Kind of trippy.
Yeah, Meg Kilty was like the Dolly, you know, and she's built up strong.
Yeah.
And I mean, voluptuous and. They and Allison Janney played me, and it was like kind of she's much taller than I am, but it looked like me, kind of lanky.
Right,
And Mr. Hart looked just like Dabney.
Wow,
it was really, and we'd be like sort of dumbstruck, and the three of us sitting there, we felt like we were watching ourselves.
Wow, that's wild. Yeah, and you and Dolly are still friends, and you. And
oh
Jenna.
Yeah.
Well, that's so nice. And you did like three movies.
Because Jane is from Tennessee.
Right.
And Dolly's from Sevierville. And
yeah.
And Jane's from Morristown. And Dolly would say, when she first met Jane, she'd say, well, we go to Morristown to get our teeth fixed.
That's hilarious. So the TV specials, it's funny because I interviewed Lorne Michaels years ago. And he wrote, one of his first writing jobs was on a show for you.
Yeah.
Correct. That was with Pryor, right?
Pryor was on the first two.
Yeah, like Lily and the Lily Tomlin special.
And that was 73.
3 and 75.
March of 73 and November of 73.
Okay, yeah.
And that second one won 2 Emmys.
Right. So with that, now how'd you meet Pryor?
Well, I used to see Pryor occasionally at the you know, the
Comedy
place.
Store?
Yeah, not the Comedy Store, the other place.
The Improv?
Yeah, the Improv.
Yeah.
So in New York.
In New York, right. Okay.
And I'd first seen him on television, on Ed Sullivan doing The Primps and the Primpses.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with him.
Yeah.
I just...
Yeah.
I was so... I'm getting chills right now, just... And so when I got a special, I wanted him on it above all.
Yeah.
And I went to him and I tried to get him to be on the special.
Yeah.
And so we had to like, we went, or he didn't, I don't think he like kind of got who I was or anything.
Yeah.
So I took, and he'd been blackballed already from Vegas. Remember all that stuff?
When he lost it. Yeah. When he got mad.
Yeah. And walked off.
Because he didn't want to be the Bill Cosby.
Flunky.
Yeah.
Bill Cosby. Yeah. I guess that was it.
Yeah.
So he, but he'd done Lady Sings the Blues.
Right.
But it was still in the can.
Oh, okay.
So he took me to the neighborhood, and everybody knew who I was from laughing, you
oh,
know.
That's so great. Which neighborhood was this? In down
I
here?
Thought, you
yeah,
know,
South Central or
yeah,
wherever.
Whatever it would be.
Watts, somewhere. Yeah.
Whatever neighborhood he felt okay about getting my endorsement.
Okay, yeah.
And because they loved, like, the old tasteful lady, you know, getting hit with wands and spreading her legs and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, they loved Ernestine, I guess. Anyway, so then he asked me to go to a porno movie with him.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, I'll go, but I'll pay my own way.
Right. Yeah.
And we did that. And we just, and anyway, we hit it off. And he was pretty soon, he was going to be on the show.
And was he a pretty big star at that point? Comedically, was that his big year?
Oh, he was, I don't think so.
Not quite yet.
Shortly after, sort of.
Uh-huh.
Because... But I was at his head. We were working on The Wino and The Tasteful Lady, who gets stuck in an elevator together. And he, and Berry Gordy called him to tell him how good he was in Lady Sings the Blue. He'd just seen a cut, and he was, and he told him he was going to be nominated.
Yeah.
And Richard was like that little primps and princess kid.
Yeah.
He was so excited and kind of couldn't believe it.
Wow.
He was so gratified.
Did he get nominated?
I don't remember.
I can't remember either. Well, he was a great actor. I mean, I just watched that one you did. Was it Opal and Juke? Or,
Juke and Opal.
Yeah,
that's
Juke and Opal.
So Jane had written that for him for the first show.
Yeah.
And Bob Precht was our partner.
Yeah.
I mean, they gave him to me, you know. And he didn't even send it over. He said, well, they're not going to let you do that.
Yeah.
And so I just, so when I, they asked me to, and I had a huge rating off of that show, and it was because of Laugh-In.
Uh-huh.
So they asked me to do another one, and I said, well, I'll do it if I don't have to have a partner.
Uh-huh. Like an executive, network executive, yeah.
Because they interfere with everything.
Sure.
And so they said they wanted somebody that they could talk to.
Yeah.
So they I interviewed everybody.
Yeah.
I interviewed Norman.
Yeah.
I went to everybody that was like a...
Norman Lear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And finally I settled on Grant Tinker.
Uh-huh.
Because he was kind of like... more mild manner. He
as did, your exec, as your executive,
as executive producer, right?
Yeah.
But even Grant would like pat my hand. He'd say, "You go home now. We'll take care of this."
Oh, yeah.
And it was just so personal for me, you know.
Yeah.
Were
you able to do what you wanted to do with Grant?
Quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, that worked.
Well,
out.
We didn't because Juke and Opal. We didn't get to do that on the first show. The second show, I had done a piece called War Games because the war in Vietnam was still on.
Right.
Almost going to be off, maybe. And so I had a game where a woman, Mrs. Beasley, goes in the backyard and there's a war going on in her backyard.
Right. Yeah.
And so I taped it for the first show.
Yeah.
Didn't get on. Yeah. I mean, they just stopped. No, it's not going to go on. It's not going to go on and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so the second show, I taped Juke and Opal, and I taped War Games to Bargain with it.
Okay.
I'd learned that from George.
Oh, yeah. So you knew you'd get one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted Juke and Opal.
Yeah. It's such a sweet thing. It's almost like a little play.
Yeah.
And that's the one with Alda, too. He comes in.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So which show was that?
I don't know which one.
What year was it? Well, then that was the second show.
It must have been the second show. Let's see. No, here we go. 73. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
November of 73.
Yeah.
That was our second show.
Okay. Yeah.
And was that the one that had...
Lauren wrote on that one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first show he wrote.
It was Alan Alda, you, and Bill Gerber.
Yeah.
You've been in the business a long time.
Yeah, 50 years.
So what's it like now? Do you love it?
Yeah, I do. I mean, Jane Fonda and I loved doing Grace and Frankie. And, of course, she's been in D.C. for the last 3 or 4 months.
Getting arrested.
Yeah.
Old school Jane.
I went last 27th.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't going to have too many people because it was right after the holidays. So my Jane had taken a fall and hurt her shoulder. And I really didn't want to leave her. And so I wasn't able to go in the beginning. But it was sweet to go and be with Jane.
Yeah. She's serious. She means business.
Oh, yeah.
She really is connected, you know, to what it is that she believes in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you find...
And always has been.
Yeah. Now, you've done a lot of exploring with that stuff, and you grew up in a pretty Christian household, apparently.
Christian. My father wasn't Christian.
Oh, no, just your mom?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
My dad would take me to the track and the bookie joints on Saturdays, and my mother would take me to church on Sunday.
So you got both sides.
It was very, very lovely childhood.
Where'd you land spiritually, though? Do you have anything, or you don't think about it?
No, I'm not religious at all.
But do you have any belief? Do you have any? What keeps you? What outside of the massive amount of supplements? What keeps you sane? Work.
I'm not so sane.
No.
But I don't need anything like that.
But you're not the character in Grace and Frankie either. You know, I mean, she's kind of a kook, right?
Oh yeah.
You must have friends that ended up like that from
the
old days.
Well,
that generation of free spirits from the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's living a commune and stuff like that.
Yeah. I noticed that when I was watching Nashville that expansive way of life, the sexual nature and just the sort of open mindedness of that time. I romanticize about it. Do you ever get nostalgic for it, or am I idealizing that period?
No, I think I don't miss it. I never was part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was part of everything.
Yeah.
Whenever I could play the room.
Yeah, right. But you didn't get caught up with the trends or everything.
No.
You know.
I like drugs, but I don't take them.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean,
I took them a little. I dabbled in them and stuff like that.
After a certain point.
And it's fun, but then you think, oh, God. So my friends have Parkinson's. I'm so worried that.
Oh. Did they? They got it?
A lot of them do.
You think it was from the coke?
I wonder.
I wonder, too. I wonder, too.
If it didn't have some element.
Maybe something it was cut with. Who knows?
Yeah.
Because I've thought about that myself. I guess at that time, too, heroin was bad, too. I mean, there's a lot of people went
I knew a lot of people who snorted heroin.
Yeah. A lot of people died, probably.
Yeah, I don't know.
Back in the day.
I never did it either.
Yeah. I tried it. It wasn't my thing. I snorted it once. I liked going fast. I didn't like going slow.
Oh, yeah. I like going fast. I like going fast, too. But
yeah. But, you get older, you don't need that shit anymore.
No, you don't.
Because you want to stay alive.
That's part of it.
Yeah. And also, you don't want to freak out. I mean, you get to a certain age where if your heart starts fluttering, on its own, you're panicking. Why increase the possibilities of that happening?
I guess you're right. I guess that's probably the truth I came to in somehow intuitively.
Yeah, of course. Is it worth, what do you want to panic when you're fucking 70 over drugs? I mean, I'm like 56. I've been sober for 20 years.
You've got a whole life ahead of you.
I know, and it doesn't involve cocaine or pot or anything.
You've got a whole life ahead of you.
So wait, what season are we on with Grace and Frankie?
We're going to be shooting 7, but 6 is in the can.
Yeah, and that's what's on now.
So 6 will be released January 15th.
And people love it.
Yeah, they do.
It must be great. There must be a whole audience for, people who have been with you forever. As the fans, there must be people who are, in their 70s now who have been.
Some people have died.
Yeah. But, you're a constant in people's lives, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is.
And you're an inspiration because you keep working, and now you're married and out and comfortable. You've had a relationship for 15 years. You've never stopped working, and you keep doing provocative stuff. I think it's just it gives people hope that, you know, life is worth living, I think.
Yeah, that would be nice. God.
I think it's true. I think
I would
it's
like
true.
It, but if we can't stop the climate.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess.
That our days are.
That's for sure. Yeah. Okay. We'll work on that.
Okay.
We'll do what we can on the day-to-day basis. Enjoy Grace and Frankie. And I don't know. Try not to. Oh, God. We're back at the climate. Australia is burning.
Oh, goodness. The koalas, so many.
Oh, no.
The little kangaroos running.
Oh, no.
Running.
I hadn't thought of that yet. Well, what?
You're going to make me depressed. And
what did I didn't even do
I
it?
Don't get depressed much.
You brought up the climate.
I know.
Then
I dwell on the numbers and stuff.
Let's not do it. Let's go. Let's leave on a high note.
Okay.
It was very exciting to talk to you. I've been wanting to for a long time.
I've been trying
to talk to you.
I've talked way too much and told a lot of.
But it's all. These are nice little details. I enjoyed all of it, and I'm glad you had fun playing with the top.
Hope you don't lose any listeners.
We're not losing anybody. Thank you, Lily.
Thank you, Mark.
I love her. What an amazing treat that was for me. It's just really great. She's just amazing to talk to, an amazing person. The new season of Grace and Frankie premieres on Netflix this Wednesday, January 15th. Go watch Nashville, though, if you haven't done that in a while. Now let's fucking get psyched out. Let's do some psychedelic thing. Boomer lives.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.